Hail, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. George Fletchus, and we're going to be talking about iodine and the importance of iodine in our diet. Now, at one time, of course, we had all sorts of access to iodine. The iodine was added to our flour, it was added to the milk, it was added to all of our salt, and we did not see the goiters that at one time had plagued people up in the Great Lakes area and other parts of our country. And with all the complications of hypothyroidism and children with cretinism, but of course, we've gotten complacent about that. Now, we do know that over the last 100 years or more, the incidence of cancer has increased dramatically. Because at the beginning of the last century, why, one person in 33 in America developed cancer. Today it's about between 1 in 3 and 1 in 2. Why the dramatic increase? Well, there are lots of reasons we could give, and I'm sure there are multiple reasons, but is there any relationship between the shortage of iodine, the fact that we're just not getting iodine, and the skyrocketing increase of breast cancer and other types of cancer in our society? Well, perhaps help us answer that question and many other questions about iodine metabolism. Remember, iodine is one of those trace elements that we don't have a lot of it in our body, but absolutely essential for health. Dr. Fletchus, well, how did you get involved in this study of iodine and your interest in it? And I know you've been a great spokesman encouraging people to look into iodine and consider that there may be deficiency there.
Well, I have a master's in public health with emphasis in the field of nutrition along with my medical degree. And back in the late 1990s, there was an article in the Journal for the American Medical Association about trace minerals and what diseases were associated with a lack of these trace minerals, and one of them was this problem known as fibrocystic breast disease. Today we know it as benign breast problems, and basically what happens is just prior to a woman's menstrual cycle, that about for about a week or two she has increased breast pain, swelling, cysts, nodules, etc. So we started looking at the concept of what else is associated with iodine deficiency. And it's interesting that back in the 1960s, the Russians published some papers showing the relationship between iodine deficiency and fibrocystic breast disease. But in that paper, they also pointed out that there was a problem with increased cysts in the ovaries. And so we started looking at what happens to iodine and ovarian cysts, etc. And we knew that women who have problems with polycystic ovaries or problems with recurrent cysts of the ovaries have a higher incidence of ovarian cancer by the time they're in their late 40s, early 50s. And about 2 or 3 years ago, in the New England Journal of Medicine, they printed and showed that there was an increased association of breast cancer in patients with fibrocystic breast disease. Well, we went back 100 years ago and looked at the problem known as goiter. Goiter is an enlargement of the thyroid, and it's associated with cysts, nodules, scar tissue enlargement. And back 100 years ago, they had published showing us that people with goiter had a higher rate of thyroid cancer, had a higher rate of breast cancer, they had a higher rate of ovarian cancer and endometrial cancer, which is cancer of the lining of the uterus.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Fletchus. Why don't you go right ahead there?
We also picked up that there was a problem with increased cancer of the esophagus and increased cancer of the stomach. So there was definitely some type of relationship between these cancers and the absence of iodine in the body. Well, the Italians have over the... There's been a problem with goiter in Italy for years, especially in the Piedmont area and up towards Tuscany. And what they showed was is that people with goiter having this high incidence of cancer, and finally one of the Italian researchers came out with a term that says that the absence of iodine in the human body is a promoter of development of cancer. So we, you know, when you look at cancer, cancer is a problem where the cells of the body are dividing and multiplying very quickly, and they don't, and it's uncontrolled division. And we looked at this problem of dividing and multiplying, dividing and multiplying, and we looked at a disease, well, not a disease, it's a problem known as scar tissue. And basically, you know, you yourself are an orthopedic doctor, and when you used to do surgery, you would put sutures in a person's skin to close off the wound, and then you would ask them to put betadine or put some type of iodine preparation on the wound. Well, by the late 1980s, we noticed that people who were putting iodine on their wounds, that when the sutures were removed, the wound would just literally dehisce and open up, and there would have been very poor healing. Well, it turns out that in order for a wound to close off, you need to have what are called fibroblasts. These are cells inside of a surgical wound that help to create scar tissue so you can close off the surgical wound. And it turns out that iodine is toxic to these cells, and it keeps those cells from dividing and multiplying and keeps them from developing scar tissue. Well, it turns out that iodine induces what's called apoptosis. And it takes cancer cells and it makes them turn into normal cells, because a cancer cell thinks of itself as being immortal. And iodine takes away the immortality of cancer cells and brings them back towards...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Fletcher is simply talking about the relationship between iodine and cancer cells, and it seems to have an effect on cancer cells. How did they find this out, that there was a relationship between iodine and this immortality of the cancer cell?
Well, it turned out that, you know, when you see surgical wounds opening up, you have to ask yourself, what in the world's going on, you know? And it turns out that the cells that induce a scar called fibroblasts were literally being murdered by the iodine. Well, you know, we have diseases out there where scar tissue is a major problem, such as keloid, a major increased scar tissue problem on the skin. We have fibrous, scar tissue and fibrocystic breast disease. We have a lot of scar tissue around the ovaries. We have a lot of scar tissue and a multitude of different illnesses. And it turns out that iodine helps to decrease the formation of scar tissue. And as a result, then the tissues start behaving more normally. And, what we did was is that they have literally, like, there's a disease out there known as Peyronie's disease, which is a problem of increased scar tissue around the male genital organ. And it turns out that that helps to decrease the scar tissue there. So we've actually, here at my office, done x-rays of our patients we will put patients on about 50 milligrams of iodine per day. And 2 or 3 years later, we will do a repeat mammogram. Now, when we first do the mammogram, you look at it, and the tissues are just literally whited out. Everything is white. The poor radiologist couldn't see cancer if he wanted to because there's so much scar tissue in there. And in studies that have been done so far, they've been able to demonstrate that with the use of iodine, that there is a 50 to 90% reduction in the scar tissue inside the breast within a period of about 2 to 3 years. And it's easily seen on repeated mammograms that that scar tissue goes down. So that we feel that iodine is definitely helpful in reducing the scar problem that some patients have. There's been some recent studies looking at the issue of estrogen. As you know, in breast cancer, there's a problem of xenoestrogens. And these are estrogens that exist in the body because they're chemicals that are coming into the body that are estrogenic compounds. Illustration here would be something like DDT. When from the time that estrogen is produced in the human ovary to the time it's utilized by the tissues in the body, the estrogen will have existed maybe a total of 3.5 minutes to maybe 10 minutes. Whereas xenoestrogens, these are chemicals that out there that look like estrogens, such as DDT. The half-life of DDT in the human body is almost 47 and a half years. And DDT is basically stimulating the tissues in the body as if it were an estrogen. Well, it turns out that Dr. Bernard Eskin, who is a gynecologist at Drexel University in Pennsylvania, Dr. Eskin, a few years ago, showed that that iodine decreases the estrogen receptors on the surface of a cell. As a result, anything that's an estrogen trying to stimulate a cell is not going to be able to do so because there's less receptors out there to accept whatever estrogenic compounds try to stimulate the cells. Now, Dr. Eskin has, within the last probably 6 months to a year, published a paper showing that iodine decreases the actual production of estrogen inside the body. And so that there's a definite decrease in estrogen, and as a result, less stimulation of the body cells with estrogen. And it's felt that this uncontrolled estrogen stimulation, either by xenoestrogens or your own personal estrogens, will do a lot of produce problems with increased breast cancer. Now, last August of last year, there was a paper published showing that the use of estrogen, or that estrogen in its own right, will decrease the absorption of iodine. So it looks like these two chemicals, estrogen and iodine, are opposing forces inside the body. The iodine decreasing the production of estrogen, decreasing the ability of estrogen to stimulate cells, versus estrogen, it decreasing the ability of cells to absorb iodine. So these two compounds are diametrically opposed to each other. Now, recently, we've had some issues that have arisen where we've had patients who are having difficulty absorbing iodine, and research work that we've now done show that there are two vitamins that are very crucial towards the ability of the body to bind iodine to the tissues. You can have iodine binding to the thyroid, and that alone is only 3% of all the iodine in the body is inside the thyroid. 20% of all the iodine in the body sits inside your skin. And the iodine work in the skin is basically to help you sweat. And we've had, I recently gave a lecture to a whole group of patients with cancer at the Cancer Society meetings there in Los Angeles. And at that meeting, I made mention of this, the fact that people with cancer, or actually people with iodine deficiency, have problems with being able to sweat. And out of something like 1,000 patients who were there with cancer, I must have had close to 200 of them that came up to me after my speech and sat there and said, you know, you're right. I haven't been able to sweat since I was a little girl. Or I haven't been able to sweat in the last 5 or 6 years. And then I came down with cancer. And it turns out that the absence of the ability of the body to sweat in the presence of heat is usually seen as a iodine deficiency. And again, the absence of iodine in the human body is a promoter of cancer. So that this one concept, if I have to say anything, we will probably save more lives from this one speech because of the fact that there are people out there who can't sweat no matter how hot they get, and it turns out that it's an iodine deficiency.
What do you think that the iodine, or at least the sweating, actually gets rid of some of the other toxins in their body? Because, of course, many of the cancers are related to toxicity, and you get rid of the either heavy metal toxicity or chemical toxicity, and is that what actually decreases the incidence of cancer?
I think so, but I think the major problem is that you need iodine to be able to sweat.
Right.
And without the iodine, no sweating occurs, and without the iodine, the body goes into increased risk of development of cancer. Now, 20% of all the iodine sits inside the skin, 32% of the iodine sits inside your muscles, 35% sits inside the fat. And it turns out that iodine, as a functional element, helps to protect the polyunsaturated fats, carbons that are in fat in the body from being oxidized by oxygen. And so iodine, one of its jobs is to literally protect the body from oxidation. And we've had some problems where we've given patients 50 milligrams of iodine, and when we did a 24-hour urine collection for iodine, we discovered that they urinated all 50 milligrams back out. And we've had, what we've discovered is that there are people in the population out here who, no matter how much iodine you give them, they urinate it all back out. And we've discovered this by doing the iodine testing through our laboratory in North Carolina.
Well, is that because, of course, they are already saturated with iodine, that's why they can't retain it?
You know, we thought there was a problem with saturation until we discovered that it's the absorption mechanism is what's defective. And so it wasn't that the patient was saturated, it's just the fact that the body could not absorb the iodine, period. And it turns out that it was a vitamin deficiency of niacin and riboflavin. So the doctor who's worked this up is Dr. Guy Abraham out of Torrance, California. And he put together a vitamin mixture of riboflavin that contains around 300 milligram per day and niacin in the sense of non-blushing niacin called niacinamide. And he's put that together into a pill called ATP cofactor. And what we discovered was is that these patients who were having difficulty hanging on to their iodine, that when you give them iodine plus ATP cofactor, that all of a sudden the body can hang on to iodine. In fact, the iodine can bind to the proteins inside the body, and the iodine works like it's supposed to. And we've had patients who were constantly cold all the time, and once we put them on the ATP cofactor, all of a sudden their bodies became very warm. They started sweating, and they started being able to concentrate their iodine. So, you know, one of the things that we've seen here in the population is the fact that we used to put lots of iodine in the bread. We put iodine in the milk. We put iodine in the salt. And we've taken away the iodine in the milk and taken away the iodine in the bread. And as a result, you know, there's iodine in the salt.
But not all of the salt, only about half of it. So a lot of people just aren't getting very much iodine, and we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Fletcher. All right, you go right ahead with that thought.
Actually, what's happened is that when we look at the eating habits of American women, first off, we find out that many women are not paying attention to what type of salt they're buying. They're just going out and picking up the first salt they get, and they don't care whether there's iodine in that salt or not. Number two is that when you actually look at the salt, you find out that about 50% of women are cooking with iodine, with salt that has no iodine. Now, if you speak to most physicians nationwide, they sit there and say, oh, you know what, we don't have a problem with iodine deficiency in this nation because there's lots of iodine in the salt. And what it shows you is that there's a problem with that statement in the sense that they're not, you know, they are not picking up the fact that the population is cooking with only, with half of the women out there cooking with salt with no iodine. Number two is that I'm seeing a very dangerous trend that is now developing in the medical profession, and that is that we're becoming fixated with patients with hypertension. All the medical journals within the last probably year or two are saying, look, you know, we as doctors need to concentrate on our patients to get their salt intake down because we are getting into a major epidemic of hypertension, and we need to decrease the salt intake in the population. You know, Stan, one of the problems is that if you look at our population of age 60 and above, that almost one-fourth of all the people who become senile due to lack of thyroid hormone production. Well, you can't make thyroid hormone if you don't have iodine, and you can't have enough iodine if you cut back on the iodized salts you're eating. So that there's a big push within the medical societies of North America to cut the salt intake in the older population by one half. Well, if you do that, you can end up with a lot more people becoming low thyroid, hypothyroid. And with that, you're going to end up with a higher amount of people becoming senile due to lack of thyroid hormone production. So, and the other problem that we've seen is that of what happens to iodine in pregnancy. The absence of iodine in early pregnancy was just published about 3 or 4 years ago from a group out of Italy, and they showed that the absence of iodine in early pregnancy produces children who become cretin, or no, they develop problems with attention deficit disorder. And we've looked at the problem of attention deficit disorder in adults, and from the year 2000 through about 2004, 2005, right in there, the incidence of attention deficit disorder nationwide in adults has gone up almost 500%. Well, if you go back in time, you go back 20, 30 years ago, that's when we took the iodine out of the bread, we took the iodine out of the milk, and we're left down to just iodine in the salt. Well, that's just enough iodine to keep the thyroid from having too much problems, such as hypothyroidism, but it was not enough iodine to take care of the breast, the skin, the muscles, the fat, and so on and so on.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Fletcher, and certainly you were talking about the fact that many of our citizens are put on a low-salt diet. What about the people who the doctor puts on a salt substitute diet? Certainly, what is a salt substitute diet? Will that actually meet any of the requirements for iodine?
Not really, because the salt substitute is mainly a potassium chloride. And as far as I know, they don't make potassium chloride with added iodine.
All right, fine. So I think that's an important issue.
Yep. The thing that's unique here is that you look at a lot of our women who get pregnant, they end up with problems with hypertension throughout their pregnancy. And so we'll take them off salt while they're pregnant. And it turns out that iodine is crucial towards development of a normal brain system for children. And the absence of iodine during pregnancy is producing children who have attention disorder. The problem is that, let's say you've got a child right now that's 5 or 6 years old and they have attention disorder, you can't go back and give them iodine and hope that the brain works like it's supposed to, because the human brain develops and does its best in the first 3 years of existence. That is, the first 10 months in utero inside the mother, and then the next 2 years after the birth of the baby, that's when the brain is developing and the IQ is developing. And if you give children iodine throughout this time cycle, you can increase the IQ of those kids by 10 to 15 points. Sometimes that makes the difference whether you've got a child who's a genius versus just an average Joe.
I think one of the big things that really bothers me is, of course, they're telling women that, oh, my goodness, you shouldn't eat fish. Pregnant women shouldn't eat fish because of the mercury in it, and never tell them that, of course, they're going to get about as much mercury from eating a helping of fish as they would from one day of their mercury fillings venting into them, except your mercury fillings vent into you every single day. And so there's a very, very tiny amount of mercury in the fish. This is not a factor. But, of course, what you're doing is depriving them of iodine in the process. And unfortunately, so much of the advice we're giving is harmful. There might be a few fishes, maybe the shark and a couple of those swordfish, that are heavy in mercury. But the average fish is not going to be that harmful, anywhere near as harmful as the mercury fillings that half our dentists are still putting in people and poisoning them. So many of these women are iodine deficient during the pregnancy and damaging their children, and they have no idea what they're doing.
Yep, and that's right. And, you know, the other thing, too, is should a mother be able to take iodine while she's nursing a baby? And the answer is yes. You know, if you we're always going to go back to our Japanese friends, because in Japan, the average Japanese woman is eating about 13.8 milligrams of iodine per day. And the Japanese are eating seaweed 3 to 4 times a day. They eat seaweed for breakfast, they eat seaweed for lunch, they have seaweed for supper, plus they have seaweed in their snacks. So in Japan, you're going to find gummy bears with seaweed. You're going to find soda crackers with seaweed. You're going to find they put seaweed in everything you can think of. And the thing is that seaweed is loaded with iodine, and it's helping them to produce a generation of very intelligent people. The thing that we need to do here in the United States is that we need cooking schools, but we need cooking schools where we teach our population how to eat marine vegetables. I mean, maybe if we could figure out how to put seaweed into grilling, then we can have the men grill their chickens outside with some seaweed on it. But we definitely need, in the public health arena of North America, we need to have cooking schools where we teach the population about cooking with marine vegetables. And there's about 20 or 30, seaweeds that are being sold in the United States. You can take here in the South, we go around adding greens to our beans. We add greens to our roast. And so on. And the same thing is true here. We can start adding seaweed to our different types of foods that we have, like, you know, when you make some rice, add some seaweed dulse to it. It's going to give it just a slight fishy flavor, but it's going to add iodine to it. But we just need to do that. As a result, you can take a woman that's nursing her baby and give that woman 13.8 milligrams or 12.5 milligrams of iodine while they're nursing the baby, and you'll find out that the babies do just fine, and in fact, the children turn up to have a higher IQ.
Well, of why, you have to ask yourself, why would we, of course, be restricting the iodine on our people today when we know our children, when they graduate from high school, can't compete?
That's right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Fletcher's, and please go right ahead with your story because I think it's so important. Iodine is so essential for the normal development of the child's brain. The worst thing you could do would be, of course, to give them mercury, and yet we're giving mercury influenza shots to women in the first trimester when there's no evidence that it'll help prevent influenza, but there's all the evidence in the world that it'll do harm, and we start giving our children the mercury shots when they're 6 months of age. Used to give it in the nursery, but we've stopped doing that, and they get their mercury shot and their influenza every year. That doesn't do a bit of good, but it does immeasurable harm. And yet something as simple as iodine, you know, for the mother, pregnant woman, and for the newborn child, a wonderful situation, and we're not providing it. You have to ask yourself, why? Go right ahead.
Well, you know, the other thing that we've discovered is that there was some studies done a few years ago in China, with some populations where there was very marginal intake of iodine in the population. And severe iodine deficiency in pregnancy will produce children that are called cretins. And a cretin is basically a very mentally retarded child. And they can grow up, and cretinism is something that will affect that child the rest of its life. That turns out that in China, they had a certain population where there was just marginal intake of iodine, just enough to keep them from producing cretins. Then what they did is that they took some of those communities and they started adding fluoridated water. Now, fluoride competes with iodine for its function inside the body. And what happened is that with adding fluoride to the water, in these patients who were already marginal with iodine intake, all of a sudden there was a massive increase in the amount of children coming out who were having problems with cretinism. And, and in North America, you look at it, back in 1997, the American Thyroid Association showed that about 11.7% of the population was hypothyroid, low thyroid. And recent studies that we've done through our laboratories are showing that that number is now up at about 17.4% of the population. So if you start having more and more people having less and less salt intake with less iodine, and then you give the mother fluoridated water, what types of children are we producing? We're producing a bunch of imbeciles. What's interesting
Hold that thought for just a moment here. And, of course, certainly Dr. Fletcher is talking about the areas, of course, in China where they have, you know, where they actually had fluoride in the water. And when, of course, low iodine and fluoride in the water. And so those children really had terrible problems, you know, as far as their minds were concerned. They needed the iodine, and the worst thing you could do was add fluoride to it. And when they added fluoride to those drinking water, of course, the children had a sharp drop in their IQ. And then, of course, here, why many of our stores sell distilled water with fluoride added to it so you can give it to your children. The worst thing you could possibly do, of course, this has a toxic effect on the brain. We know it lowers the intelligence. Why would they be doing things like that? Well, go on and pick the story up there, please, George.
We definitely feel that there is something going on in the sense that, why are we adding so much fluoride in the water, especially in the cities, as compared to the country folk who get their water straight out of a well. And those families are being encouraged to, quote, give their children fluoridated distilled water. And you can imagine what's going to happen to those children as time progresses. The other problem is that a lot of children are being fed, quote, baby foods instead of food off the table, but they're being given baby food. And what's interesting is the baby food is you know, because of our concern with hypertension, we are taking these babies and we're giving them baby food with no salt. And where is, you know, if the last bastion of iodine is in the area of salt, and there's no salt in the diet, where are these newborn children getting their iodine from? They're not getting it at all. And then we give them fluoridated water to boot, and you can see where the problems are.
And I think it's important people understand that, of course, as far as the thyroid is concerned, while the fluoride competes with iodine, they come from the same part of the periodic table, and so they simply replace the fluoride replaces the iodine in the thyroid, and then, of course, you end up with marked hypothyroidism. You're not producing the thyroxine, and, of course, the brain isn't going to develop normally, or is it, well, the rest of the child, really.
That's right. Now, the other thing, too, that's going on is that we're going to go back in time about 100 years ago, and we had a product that was out there for patients who were drinking too much alcohol and then waking up with a hangover the next morning. We had a product called Bromo Seltzer, and Bromo Seltzer was made over here in Baltimore, and the problem with Bromo Seltzer is that it would give you a problem with abnormal heartbeats. Bromo Seltzer would give you problems with atrophy of the male testicles. Bromo Seltzer was giving people problems with increased acute paranoid psychosis, otherwise known as schizophrenia. And probably between 1920 and 1960 here in North America, about 20 to 30% of people being admitted to psychiatric hospitals with acute paranoid schizophrenia were due to the fact that these people were taking lots of Bromo Seltzer. In today's world, we are decreasing the intake of Bromo Seltzer, but we've substituted a new product in there called Alka-Seltzer. Now, back in 1964, we had a soda drink that was introduced that was loaded with bromide and same stuff as in Bromo Seltzer, and it too is causing problems with bad breath, abnormal heartbeats, abdominal pain, and so on. And if you look at the soda drinks, you will notice that on the side label where there is ingredients listed, you'll note that it says brominated vegetable oil. And these are basically in the soda drinks that have a citrus flavor to them. So you'll see citrus flavored Gatorade with brominated vegetable oil. Citrus flavored Fresca, brominated vegetable oil.
What about Mountain Dew? Does that have anything?
Citrus flavored Mountain Dew with brominated vegetable oil. And in fact, there was a product that was introduced in England just about 2 or 3 years ago where the Coke company, Coca-Cola, introduced a grape drink which contained brominated vegetable oil, but they didn't have it listed on the ingredients on the side of the bottle. And as a result, Coca-Cola had to withdraw something like 5 million bottles of grape drink that contained brominated vegetable oil. This stuff is not exactly safe, and the bromide in there is causing problems. Bromide gets absorbed into the thyroid gland just as easily as fluoride or iodine, but the Czechoslovakians have published some papers just in the last few years showing that that when bromide gets into the thyroid gland, bromide causes thyroid cancer. Now, you can go to Google on the Internet and just type in the word bromism, and you will see papers that have been published now showing that bromide toxicity or bromism is not exactly safe. And, you know, here in I'm in North Carolina, and between Asheville, North Carolina, and over towards Knoxville, and in eastern Tennessee, western North Carolina area, a lot of our teenagers are drinking about 5 to 6 bottles of Mountain Dew per day. In fact, I went over to my son's high school, and I looked at the commons area where they were selling soft drinks, And in the commons area, there were 12 vending machines. Of the 12 vending machines, only two were selling things like Coca-Cola, milk, orange juice, etc. 10 out of the 12 machines were all selling high doses and very big bottles of Mountain Dew. So that, if you wonder why in the world are we having kids that are going around trying to kill their teachers, trying to kill their fellow students, becoming very paranoid. I'll tell you, one of the reasons that we're seeing this is because of the bromide we're feeding them through the soda drinks. Now, here in Asheville, we have a place called the Grove Park Inn. And if you'll go in, and Dr. Grove was a doctor back in the 1800s who traveled up and down the roads of these mountains because trying to help mountain families to fatten up their skinny little children. And so Dr. Grove had a special formula built to take your little skinny little children and make them as fat as little pigs. And if you go to the Grove Park Inn and look at the original pictures that Dr. Grove put on his medicine bottles, it's the face of a child on a pig. And the name of the medication was called brominated quinine. He was giving bromide with quinine to these children to make the children as fat as little pigs. And I want to tell you something, we're doing basically the same thing today, except we call it by a different name. We're calling it brominated vegetable oil. And this may help to explain why we're having such a problem with obesity in our children, and also why some of them are literally going crazy on us and going around shooting their parents, their fellow schoolmates, their teachers. And it's because of bromism. So go look it up on the internet. You'll see what I'm talking about. It's causing major problems. The other thing, too, is that within the last probably 10 or 15 years, there's been an increasing amount of problems with infertility among males. The sperm count nationwide has dropped almost by one half over the last 10 or 15 years. And if you look up bromism, you'll find out that bromide is toxic to the human testicle, and it's causing all sorts of damage. So I think this problem with iodine is just the tip of an iceberg of medical problems that are just, that are going to slowly increase within this population.
And I think really what people have to realize, they're going to have to learn these things and look after their health, because the government is actually encouraging fluoridation of water, which, of course, has all sorts of problems, and, of course, going right along with the aspartame that produces pathological obesity and failing to speak out on the mercury. They know what they're doing. Oh, they're poisoning the American people, and if you want to survive, you're going to have to learn the things that Dr. Fletcher is talking about and that we talk about here, and get the books, get the information, and protect your family, because believe me, you can't depend upon the government. Go right ahead, George.
Yeah, actually, the question arises is, if I take iodine, is that going to decrease my risk of cancer? We had a situation up here in Boston where they took a whole group of about 25,000 women, and they gave them about 5 milligrams of iodine per day. And they had approximately a greater than 50% reduction in the rate of breast cancer development in those 25,000 women. So will taking iodine decrease your risk of development of breast cancer? The answer is yes. And it's such a simple thing to do. And again, in order to help the iodine to bind to the proteins inside the body, we're not just talking about binding to thyroid, but binding to the proteins in the body, you need to have a combination of riboflavin, about 300 milligrams a day, and niacin in the form of non-blushing niacinamide. And patients need about 1,000 milligrams of that a day, along with their iodine to help the iodine bind and to do its job effectively inside the human body.
Well, now, what about the relationship between, of course, iodine and fibrocystic disease in women? Because this is very, very distressing for women, especially at the time of their cycle. I mean, if they're on iodine, does it decrease the incidence of fibrocystic disease?
Yes, and in fact, it's interesting that you need iodine to be able to make thyroid hormone. You need iodine in order for the ovaries to make the appropriate steroids that are necessary for normal ovarian function. It's interesting that when you give iodine to the thyroid makes thyroid hormone. But the human ovary has little follicles that develop, and these follicles is where you make the estrogen. But it turns out that the follicles of the ovaries also have the ability to make thyroid hormone. And the other tissue that has that ability is the white blood cell. So that we have three tissues that we've been able to identify so far that have the ability to make thyroid hormone independent of the gland itself. Now, it turns out that you need iodine for normal ovarian function. You need iodine for normal breast function. And the absence of iodine, the breast starts getting these cysts, these nodules, these scar tissue, very painful breast tissue, and it turns out that once you start women on iodine, this problem goes away within just a matter of a few weeks. In fact, we've done follow-up studies on patients who have been taking iodine, and these patients were taking 50 milligrams a day, and we followed them with serial mammograms, which means that we did mammograms about once a year. And what we found was that the scar tissue in the breast went down by greater than 50 to 90% within a period of about 3 years. And whereas the radiologists would look at these breasts and not be able to see through them because there was so much scar tissue, that with the use of iodine, the scar tissue went down, and the radiologist could see through the breast, and he could see if there was any gross abnormalities present. But the scar tissue goes down, the pain goes down, the patients feel better, and everything literally turns around for a lot of these patients as far as the breast is concerned. What's interesting, though, is like, let's say 5 years after they've had the problem, they stop taking the iodine. Within a period of about a few months, the breast pain comes right back. So that there is a definite relationship between the absence of iodine and the development of fibrocystic breast disease and the breast pain. So that we just encourage the patients to stay on iodine the rest of their lives. I mean, you look at it, you've got a whole nation of people, the Japanese, who eat iodine 13.8 milligrams on a daily basis just about all their lives. It's not just the Japanese, it's also the Koreans. They're eating huge amounts of iodine, and these patients and these populations have some of the lowest rates of cancer. And in fact, I think in some of these populations, such as Japan, there's no such word as fibrocystic breast disease because it doesn't exist. Why? Because Japanese women are eating so much iodine in their diet. So that some words that we have as regular medical words here in America, some of these words don't exist overseas because the disease is not there. In fact, in Japan, the Japanese women probably have the lowest rates of breast cancer in the world. Why? Because they eat so much seaweed in their dietary and they're getting so much iodine on a daily basis. Now, our women, you know, you look at fibrocystic breast disease, you're talking about 94% of American women who have this particular problem. This is not just, you know, 10% little pocket here or 5% little pocket there. We're talking 94% of all American women have this problem. That's how big this epidemic is about iodine deficiency nationwide. So that this is why this message has got to get out to the population, because it's a very simply rectified problem that can be, you know, taken care of with women taking iodine.
I shall have to admit the first time I heard Dr. Fletcher speak, I was a little skeptical, but having heard him speak several times and then having checked this information out with very, very reliable medical sources that we know, for instance, Dr. Donald Miller, professor up at the University of Washington, and Dr. Blaylock. In fact, we offer an article by Dr. Miller to anybody, of course, who wants information on iodine. And, of course, we send it out routinely with those people who get our four-tape set or get the Iodorol, which we offer. And Iodorol is about 12.5 milligrams of iodine. And certainly I take it, my wife takes it, and we think it's very important in maintaining health. And you have a lot of your patients on iodine, don't you, Dr. Fletcher?
Yes, sir, I sure do. And that's why I can talk the way I do. And, you know, what's also interesting is that there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Deary up in Calgary, Canada. And Dr. Deary did a study showing that in Japan, men rarely die of prostate cancer, whereas in the United States, if a heart attack doesn't kill you, your prostate cancer will. And it turns out that iodine keeps prostate cancer from spreading throughout the body. It locks it into the prostate, and it doesn't allow it to spread.
I mean, there's so many parts of this. In fact, we have a two-hour interview with Dr. Fletcher in our four-tape set. We think the information is so vitally important, and I think you will as well. Anyway, we're going to be back in just a moment. Our guest this evening has been Dr. George Fletcher, and, of course, talking about the iodine epidemic that is all across America. Well, do you have a website or any information you'd like to get out?
Sure do. You can reach, I have a website called helpmythyroid.com. So you can reach that. That tells you a lot about what I've been talking about. We also have some of the articles that we published in the medical literature about iodine and its effects upon the body. You can download those articles for free. You can also, we recommend to a lot of, to just about everyone, please do an iodine loading test first. This test is a test that was built to try to justify why you would want to expose yourself to iodine. And basically the test helps people to determine how really sick they are. And what's happened is we've had a lot of people who started taking iodine, and then they did the test, and then they came back and said, you know, I've been taking iodine for a whole year, and my body isn't saturated. You know, what's going on? And I ask, you know, well, what was your starting numbers? Oh, I don't know. I just started taking iodine. And so I basically say, you know, it helps us if we know where your baseline is at and then what you're like 3 or 4 months later. And that helps me to help you be able to make the right decision about where to go next. But again, we recommend the use of the Iodorol because it's 100% absorbed, and it's and then along with that, the new product called ATP cofactor, 2 pills per day, and that helps the iodine to bind to the tissues inside the body. And putting that combination together has been definitely a major help to everyone who's been trying to take this.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly appreciate so much all your work really trying to get the information out, because this be something I think everybody should be aware of. But I will have to admit that when I was practicing medicine, I'd never heard most of the things that you're saying. We knew the women were miserable with a fibrocystic disease in their breast. We knew, of course, the skyrocketing rates of breast cancer. And, of course, there are many causes of breast cancer. This is simply one. But anyone, of course, everyone wants as much protection as they can get. And certainly the relationship to cancer of the prostate is fascinating, because probably 1 in 3 men in the United States gets cancer of the prostate. Do you have a parting thought before we let you go?
All I can ask is that get, you know, people to definitely give iodine a try. Don't be scared about using iodine if you're pregnant. And by all means, if you're nursing a baby, be sure to take iodine while you're nursing the baby, because that's how the baby is going to get the iodine is through your milk.
God bless them. Thanks very much. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course, that was Dr. George Fletcher. His website is helpmythyroid.com. www.helpmythyroid.com. He has a number of articles that he's published that are there, and you're welcome to pull them down and circulate them. We offer, of course, an article by Dr. Donald Miller, the professor up at the University of Washington. Now, he's a heart surgeon, a chest surgeon, but he investigated this. He's written extensively about it. We have a four-tape set on iodine, and it's something well worthwhile listening to. Has an interview with our good friend Dr. Russell Blaylock, an interview with Dr. Donald Miller, and then a two-hour interview with Dr. Fletcher. And as you hear this, it's so hard to take it all in. But, of course, you want to listen to these a couple of times, and we do offer the iodorol. It's called iodorol, I-O-D-E-R-O-L, 12.5 milligrams of the iodine. We certainly take this, and I-O-D-E-R-A-L, iodorol, and certainly we think it's important that people take this on a regular basis. So we also have an offer of potassium iodate. That, of course, is what you'd have on hand in case there was a nuclear attack, so that you could saturate your thyroid with iodine, normal iodine, so it wouldn't pick up the radioactive iodine and either wipe out the effectiveness of the thyroid later on or predispose you to a cancer of the thyroid. So, again, we offer the iodorol, we offer potassium iodate, and then we have a four-tape set, which I think is outstanding. Information you really need to have, and then if you request it, we'll be glad to send you a copy of the article by Dr. Donald Miller. Again, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Now, a lot of what Dr. Fletcher says is known to the people in public health. They're the same people who tell you you want to, of course, use your fluoride, introduce it into the water, even though most of the water that is fluoridated contains lead and cadmium and arsenic and polonium, I believe it's 220 or polonium 20, a radioactive poison. Why would they be adding that to our water? Well, you'd have to ask the people who are doing that. They will tell you, we want to help you. We're from the government, and that's why we're fluoridating your drinking water. But, of course, that fluoride then competes with the little amount of iodine you have, and you get the fluoride in your thyroid, and it doesn't work very well. How do we understand these things? Well, you really need to hear my talk on Nundare, Call It Genocide. It's available on DVD. You need to hear my talk on the planned population reduction, a talk I gave for the Prophecy Club. And then, of course, you can go up to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And you can actually there see my article on the Population Control Agenda monograph. The Population Control Agenda monograph. And if you get some of the other items, you can simply request that. We'll be glad to send it to you free of charge. It's probably the best thing to give you the overview of the planned population agenda throughout the world today. We have a great new book by Dr. Stephen Mosher. I shouldn't say doctor. They blocked him from getting his PhD. But Stephen Mosher heads the Population Research Institute, and his book on population control is very, very important. There are people out there who have a different worldview. They think there are too many people in the world. And in fact, we have a wonderful four-tape set, really one of my favorite. It's called The New Order of the Barbarians. And it's interviews with a Dr. Dunnigan, who practiced for many years as a pediatrician in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, about a talk he heard in 1969 given by Dr. Richard Day. Dr. Day had the former medical director of Planned Parenthood, and Dr. Day said, look, there are too many people in the world. They're going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. We have treatments for cancer, and we're keeping them suppressed. Now, this was 1969. 1969, they had treatments for cancer they were suppressing. If you don't believe the suppressed treatments, you can go up on my website and pull down the Fitzgerald report that's been suppressed for many years. Since 1953 or 54, the Fitzgerald Report. And then remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. And then please, our website, radioliberty.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, of course, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who's certainly one of our favorite guests. And he's with us on a regular basis. William was the senior editor for the New American Magazine for many years, and now he's working with the Wealth Society, and he is, of course, getting information out. He writes a blog. We'll tell you later how to get his blog. We carry William's book, Liberty in Eclipse, and the story of the impending police state in America, and people say that could never happen here. And I would like to suggest it not only could happen here, it is happening here. They have a network of informants across America. They're keeping dossiers on literally every American citizen. And it's not just simply the terrorists. They're listening to all of your telephone calls, Project Echelon, but we don't want to get into those things. We want, of course, to get William's view on what's going on today. So without further ado, William, thank you so very much for being with us.
I am so glad to be with you again this evening, Dr. Stan.
Well, what are we going to talk about?
I think we're going to have to talk about the situation in former Soviet Georgia, which is, I think, sort of a forerunner or a portent of the type of conflicts we're likely to see over the next several years. Former Soviet Georgia, of course, is the birthplace of a fellow by the name of Joseph Stalin. That's how he's known in history, in any case. That wasn't his birth name, but he was born in Georgia, and he ended up, after a career as a bank robber and a very prominent member of a revolutionary underground, becoming one of the founding Bolsheviks who seized Russia in 1917 with the invaluable help of the West, particularly some of the larger banking interests. He went on to become the most prolific mass murderer of the 20th century. In 1992, after the apparent collapse of the Soviet Union, that is to say, the Soviet Union was taken into receivership in 1991, and it changed its name in December of 1991, January of 1992, to the basically, now you have the Russian Federation, and after this happened in 1992, there had been fighting within Georgia involving a group of ethnic Russian separatists in an area called South Ossetia. And there was a peace arrangement worked out in which you had Russian and South Ossetian and Georgian troops patrolling a border between Georgia and this little Russian ethnic Russian enclave within Georgia. And what most people don't understand is that in 1992 and 1993, the United States started to get involved in Georgia under Eduard Shevardnadze, who'd been the last foreign minister of the Soviet Union. He became the president of post-Soviet Georgia. And we had, at that time, an elite bodyguard of Green Berets who were taking care of the personal security of Eduard Shevardnadze and also keeping in touch with their corresponding members within the special forces of Georgia and training them and providing them with military and tactical advice and also helping to arm and equip them. This is way back in 1990 to 1993. There was a U.S. Green Beret who was killed in, I believe, 1994 and buried with military honors as a result of a border clash in South Ossetia. So you have a situation where for the last 15 years almost, the United States has been involved in the affairs of post-Soviet Georgia. And it's also part of the larger architecture of NATO in that Georgia has been involved in the Partnership for Peace, which is a preliminary to joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And there are several thousand Georgian troops in Iraq right now. I believe they've got the third largest national contingent after the United States and Great Britain.
Well, you hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grigg as we talk about, of course, this impending conflict in Georgia today. Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, earlier this year, there was a training exercise. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but there was training exercise involving I believe, over 1,000 U.S. Marines in Georgia working with the Georgian military. As a matter of fact, I believe this only ended a couple of weeks ago. And if you roll back the clock a little bit to 2003, Georgia was one of the areas targeted by the neocon elite in Washington, who are Marxist by disposition and outlook. They're disciples of Leon Trotsky. They believe in the permanent global revolution. They were targeted, the Georgians were, for one of these color-coded revolutions. It was called the Rose Revolution in Georgia. And you have the U.S. Agency for International Development and the National Endowment for Democracy and the International Republican Association, International Democratic Association. All these groups were pouring in taxpayer dollars into Georgia in order to promote the campaign of a U.S.-trained lawyer who is now the president of post-Soviet Georgia. His name is Mikhail Saakashvili. And they brought this man to power, and supposedly this was being done as part of a strategic drive in the so-called War on Terror, because in 2002, the United States beefed up its already existing special forces presence in post-Soviet Georgia.
And I think it's very important for people to understand that the United States has military troops stationed in
everywhere.
130 nations throughout the world, where, of course, we are keeping ruthless tyrants and dictators in power who will go along with our plan for a one-world government. This is really what it's all about.
Exactly.
We can't tell the American people that. They have to believe it's all altruism, it's all about democracy. And, of course, it's not. It is simply we are installing a ruthless dictator who will, of course, carry out our programs and backing him up with our troops. And the American taxpayers don't understand that we're financing this move towards the one-world government, the one-world religion, the one-world rulers. Pick this story up there, William.
Yeah, exactly. And Mr. Saakashvili is a pretty good example of what we're talking about here. He's trained in the United States. His outlook is pretty much cognate with that of the neocon elite in Washington. And last year, about a year and a half ago, he declared a state of national emergency, started shutting down all the media and imprisoning people who were perceived to be a part of the political opposition. This is all being done, of course, in the name of democracy. And so if you fast forward just a few months ago, you have this training exercise where the U.S. military is in post-Soviet Georgia. I use post-Soviet as sort of a gesture to accommodate the prevailing perception here. You can call it Soviet Georgia. You can call it the Georgia SSR, but we're talking about that part of the former Soviet Union.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Go right ahead.
We're talking about that part of the former Soviet Union that's in the Caucasus, and Trans-Caucasus, I should say. But the point is, we had this training exercise a few months ago where the Marines were in there training Georgian forces, and suddenly, just in the last couple of days, we have this incident involving a border skirmish once again with the separatist forces in South Ossetia. And because we have this happening where we have, I believe, 10 Russian troops who were killed, who were part of this peacekeeping force that was put together not through the United Nations specifically, but rather on a multilateral basis with Russia and Georgia and the United States in an advisory capacity. And 10 Russian troops who were killed. We had an outbreak of violence and a column of refugees pouring into Russia from South Ossetia. And then you had Russian tanks roll into Georgia and Russian planes start to go into Georgian airspace. And apparently there were attacks on Russian armored columns. There were attacks on Russian aircraft. And now we have a shooting war between Russia and Georgia.
Well, I heard a lot of civilians have been killed there.
Yeah,
have you heard those stories?
Yeah, hundreds of refugees apparently were killed. Either as a means of deliberate policy, whether they're being directly attacked by Georgian forces or if they're caught in the crossfire. But, yeah, hundreds of refugees have been killed. And there are a number of people who have analyzed this and say, well, what's going on here is because you've got this Trans-Caucasian pipeline that is being developed so as to circumvent the Russian sphere of influence, that this becomes a very critical geographic and geostrategic area. Georgia's of great value to the United States and to certain European interests, and also to Israel.
I think it's important. What you're really talking about, of course, is a pipeline that would come from the Middle East and that would bypass Russia, go through Georgia, and then come into Europe. Is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah, it would circumnavigate Russia basically and be outside of outside of Russia's control. That might play a role here. I'm cynical enough to believe, given the fact that this is all going on when the Olympics have begun in Beijing, the world's attention's focused on Beijing. You have, I believe, both George W. Bush and I believe Vladimir Putin, who's now prime minister but really running the Russian government. Both of them are now in Beijing with their with the national delegations from those countries. I'm just cynical enough to believe that this is something that's taking place with the world's attention diverted as sort of a precursor or an overture to a larger conflict. I'm cynical enough to believe that this eruption here would be sort of a diversionary fire as a prelude to a conflict with Iran. Because if you tie down Russia's attention in their near abroad, and Georgia is considered to be part of Russia's near abroad, its sphere of influence, very intimate sphere of influence right now, chances are, if we end up with an Israeli strike on Iran and a supplemental action by the United States, the Russian military is going to be so occupied defending its own flank there in the Caucasus region that it's not going to be able to back up Iran in the event that we see the war spread from Iraq to Iran as a number of people expect it to. Of course, we've got a task force steaming to the Gulf right now. We're beefing up the naval presence in the Persian Gulf. And I think that if things really get out of hand in Georgia, that you've got the prospect here of tying down Russia in a way that will actually make Iran more vulnerable. As a matter of fact, if I were an Iranian strategic thinker, a strategic advisor to the government of Iran, I would probably be thinking of those terms right now.
Well, let me just point out, of course, that they at the present time, digging 320,000
yes.
graves in Iran. You're probably not reading about this in your newspaper, but if you have access to the Internet, you can Google in, as I did, to check out the story, even though I believe that the source was accurate. But, you know, you've got to trust but verify it. We can just type in Iran, 320,000 graves. And, yes, in many reports on the Internet, nothing in the controlled media in America. Of course, they're telling the Iranian people, oh, those are for the soldiers are going to invade us. We're going to bury all the 320,000 invading soldiers. And nobody's going to invade Iran. Of course, this is going to be an airstrike. Those, I believe, are for Iranian civilians. And they can probably put three or four bodies into every grave.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, you know. Then you don't have to worry about, of course, the spread of disease. Why would they be digging 320,000 graves in Iran at this time? And, of course, you know, the implications are frightening. And as just William says, there are at least two major naval task forces moving towards the Persian Gulf, in addition to the two we already have there, additional boats moving into the eastern Mediterranean to back up the force there in the Persian Gulf. And, of course, information we're getting, and I'd like to know what you're getting as well, William, but it looks like it's not going to be too long if the, but the Israelis would, of course, launch the attack because they don't trust Obama. And, of course, they would want to get this done before he was elected or immediately after he got elected. And the Israelis would launch the attack. But, of course, we would be considered aggressors because we provided the Buster Bunker bombs, that I think about 500 of them to the Israelis. We're letting them use our air bases for the coming attack. And that makes us really part and parcel of the attack. And then, of course, it would be retaliation on American forces. What are you hearing?
Well, what I understand, first of all, is that you've got really sort of a very elaborate charade of diplomacy going on right now. The Bush administration has been talking about opening up a diplomatic interest section in Tehran. And I believe that this is intended to disarm critics of the administration and to disarm the Iranians. Because if we had diplomats on the ground in Tehran, we obviously wouldn't be attacking. One of the things that happens as a prelude to a war conventionally is that you withdraw your diplomats. You want to get them out of the line of fire before a war begins. You call your ambassadors home, you call back your diplomatic staff. Well, in this instance, the Bush administration has been laying out some very large and pregnant hints that it intends to reopen the interest section. They've been talking about diplomacy. I think this is all by way of deception. I think that what they're doing is calculated to alter the psychology and to get people off balance who might otherwise be speaking out against the impending war. I don't think there's been any surcease in the Bush administration's intention to have a war, a conflict, a bombing campaign. followed up by some kind of major military initiative against Iran. Yesterday, Joseph Lieberman, who's very close to the most febrile wing of the neocon movement, both here and in Israel, was talking about how Iranian initiatives recently have been acts of war, that they're committing acts of war against the United States. He's talking, of course, about the fact that there are Iranian-backed insurgents in Iraq, and it just stands to reason, given the proximity of Iraq to Iran, and the fact that they're both Shiite, Muslim-dominated countries, that Iran would take an interest in what's going on in Iraq. That doesn't mean that I justify what they're doing. It's just when there are 140 or 160,000 American troops in Iraq, we're really in a bad position to criticize Iran for intervening in Iraqi affairs. But what I also understand is that there are elements of the Israeli Air Force that are being covertly stationed in Baghdad, which, of course, would cut down considerably on the amount of risk and logistical difficulty involved in an Israeli attack on Tehran. It would be the worst of both worlds in terms of a responsible approach to the situation, because it would implicate the Israelis, which, of course, would tend to broaden the war in ways that would alienate the Muslim world, while at the same time clearly implicating the United States, because it would be obvious that we had facilitated, materially aided the attack on Iran, and thereby we would be a co-belligerent in a war.
And I think listeners must understand, we are already at war with Iran. We have special forces units actually working in Iran and going in there and killing people, and we're financing the opposition, the revolutionary opposition in Iran that is killing people. We are at war with Iran, but we just haven't told the American people that, because they wouldn't understand that the elite are much smarter than we are. They know what's best for us and for the world, but the problem is, whenever you start a war, you never know how that war is going to end. And this could end as a terrible, terrible disaster.
Well, you go back to really the grand progenitor of the difficulties that we're facing right now, and the first real initiative of this self-replicating power elite to remold the world in modern times, that's World War I. Kaiser Wilhelm, who was later in life, when he wrote his memoirs, somebody who was an outspoken critic of some elements of this partially concealed elite, when he decided to press the ultimatum demands here against Serbia, he described this as rolling the iron dice, because you never know exactly what's going to happen when you roll a set of dice. Sometimes you have to roll the hard six. That's a gambling expression. And when you roll the dice, of course, you're conceding some element of your fate to random chance. And the people who are running things, of course, do have tremendous influence. They command wealth beyond our imagination. And by virtue of the fact that they're bound in many ways in a covenantal relationship with each other, you know, based on mutual greed and mutual desire to rule the world, they can cut down dramatically on the aspect of random chance, the element that plays in their calculations, but they are still subject to their own frailties, their own fallibility. They don't control everything. War is always an affair that cannot be controlled. By its very nature, it's protean and unpredictable. And the fact that we have this conflict now in Georgia with the Russians, we have, the most recent report is 1,400 dead in South Ossetia, or South Ossetian refugees moving into Russia. That's the sort of thing that can really metastasize out of control. This really is sort of a Guns of August type scenario here, because you have a proxy conflict once again, just as what happened in the Balkans in 1914 was a proxy conflict, and you had a tripwire that was pulled that put in motion all these secret pacts and brought into play all these covert alliances that resulted in this horrible conflict that really created the modern world in many ways and put an end to Christendom, put an end to Europe as a continent defined by Christian ideals. You've got the same kind of a dynamic here, where you've got Georgia, which is very obviously an asset of the United States, fighting with Russia in the near abroad as, I think, once again, a grace note to a conflict in the Persian Gulf. And this really is the sort of thing that could get very, very ugly and very, very big very soon.
And I agree with everything you're saying, Brigham, and I think it's so important. At least our listeners know what lies ahead.
It's interesting to point out here that just this last week, there was a piece on the website of a left-leaning but very good investigative journal called Mother Jones, describing a document that was developed in 2002 by the Pentagon that was an overview of empires throughout history. They reviewed empires basically from Macedonia through the British Empire. Macedonia, of course, would be Philip of Macedon, and then his more famous son, who was Alexander the Great. And then, of course, you had Rome, you had the Mongolian Empire under Genghis Khan, and then you had the Napoleonic Empire, that is the Wars of Revolution and Empire that erupted out of the French Revolution, and then Great Britain, and a number of others, empires that were studied in terms of how to maintain military dominance. This was done in 2002 as part of an initiative by the futurist wing of the Pentagon, and this came out at roughly the same time that you started hearing, or at least some of us started hearing about a fellow by the name of Thomas P.M. Barnett, who's the leading futurist of the Pentagon, a very close advisor to Rumsfeld and very deeply involved in what they call the Revolution in Military Affairs. And what Thomas P.M. Barnett did in 2000, 2001, and then in 2002 was talk about something he called the Pentagon's new map. And these two initiatives, I mean, this study of ancient empires and the idea of how to go about establishing long-term military dominance, and then Barnett's vision of reordering the world according to a new model, a new paradigm, are really complementary. The idea is that somehow the Pentagon and the people who are running the Pentagon, the civilian people who are running the Pentagon, are all very much in the neocon camp. They believe in the permanent revolution. They believe in America's an interventionist power. These people honestly believe that it's somehow possible to run the world out of the Pentagon. And Thomas P.M. Barnett, who was chosen one of the smartest people in the world by I can't remember, I think Esquire magazine, I know, did a profile on him as one of the up-and-coming thinkers. In his presentation, the Pentagon's new map, he divided the world into two zones. He said there's something we call the settled core, or the established global core, and then there's the non-integrating gap. And the global core consists of all these countries that are plugged into this system defined by the United Nations and its rule sets, and who are governed by the World Trade Organization and part of various types of multilateral agencies, particularly having to do with trade and economic affairs. All these people are part of the integrated core. The non-integrating gap, on the other hand, are all these countries that are not part of this architecture. And what Thomas P.M. Barnett said, and I've got a videotape of this presentation, it's breathtaking in its audacity and arrogance. What he said is, take a look at the non-integrating core, and you overlay that on a map of the world, and it's pretty much the entire Muslim world. So that's where our wars are going to be fought in the foreseeable future. And what we have to do is we have to reorganize the military into two groups. There has to be what they call the systems administrator group, who would be the people that go in and help build the global community on the ground in these various countries once they're being integrated. And there would have to be something he called the Leviathan Force. And the Leviathan Force would be the people that go out and basically kill people and break things.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William was talking about this one thinker, this one planner at the Pentagon, who really says, of course, that if you look at what's going on in the world today, the one area of the world we have people who won't go along with the general plan, which is really, of course, this plan that America will dominate the world and bring in this one world government and one world religion and of course, this one world ruler. But the one group that will not go along with that, of course, is the Muslim world. And this is, of course, why we're in Afghanistan today, why we are in Iraq, why we are going to war with Iran and Syria, why we are eventually going to be at war with Pakistan and with the remainder Muslim world. And this is really what it's about. We can't tell the American people because they're not smart enough to understand that the elite know what's best for us and for the world. Mm-hmm. They have a different world view. I believe it's because they worship a different god, but be that as it may, there is no question at all that they are intentionally going to take us into a war with the Muslim world. They're doing everything they can to get the Christians in this country to hate the Muslims, and everything in the Muslim nations to get the Muslims to hate the Christians. That's how you get a good war going.
Sure.
Pick the story up there.
You cultivate hatreds, and by doing so, you eventually harvest bloodshed. And the idea is that by doing so, you're somehow creating the conditions in which a new world can take root and flourish. But, of course, what happens is that every time they do this, these people who are involved in cultivating these hatreds and arranging mass bloodshed, and these architects of a vastly different world, are conceited enough to believe they actually control all the factors, and they don't. I mean, they control a great deal of what goes on in the world, but particularly when you're involved in warfare, there's always something that happens that you don't quite expect. Well, what Mr. Thomas P.M. Barnett, this very world-renowned futurist, who now writes a syndicated column and is otherwise very well positioned to influence public opinion, particularly in academia and the better-informed news consumers, way back in 2002, he was anticipating a war in Iraq. He was talking about it as a done deal. Bear in mind, this is somebody who had the ear of Donald Rumsfeld and was privy to a lot of the conversations that were taking place post-2001, post-9/11, about the military initiatives that were forthcoming. He was talking about the fact, and I'm quoting now, "When the United States finally goes to war again in the Persian Gulf, will not constitute a settling of old scores or just an enforced disarmament of illegal weapons or a distraction in the war on terror. Instead, it will be a tipping point. Our next war in the Gulf will mark an historical tipping point, the moment when Washington takes real ownership of strategic security in the age of globalization. The conflict in Iraq," Barnett explained, and I'm quoting now, "forces America to come to terms with what I believe is the new security paradigm or model that shapes this age, namely, disconnectedness defines danger. Saddam Hussein's outlaw regime is dangerously disconnected from the globalizing world, from its rule sets, its norms, and all the ties that bind countries together in mutually assured dependence." Now, bear in mind once again from what Mr. Barnett was saying here, the real target wasn't Iraq. Iraq was sort of a subsidiary target. The real target was America. The point of that war, he was saying, was to create a new role for America and to get Americans to think in terms of global obligations and to perceive countries not plugged in to this United Nations administered global system as dangerous because they're independent from that system. Disconnectedness defines danger. Now, he talks about these rule sets that supposedly define the world under the United Nations, and particularly under the WTO. And when he talks about countries that are governed by regimes like the one in Russia and the one in China, what he says is that actually they're not so problematic. They're good global citizens because they both sit on the UN Security Council. They both are involved with various multilateral economic and diplomatic entities. They're both part of this architecture. Whereas on the other hand, some of the smaller countries that are not part of this global system have to be looked upon as potential danger spots. And so as a matter of preempting terrorism, you have to go through and force these countries into this UN-administered framework. Whether this is done with the explicit backing of the UN Security Council or not, according to Barnett, and this very much, I think, reflects the thinking of the Bush administration, whether or not you have the explicit blessing of the UN Security Council, the objective is to enhance the United Nations, at least as a tool of Washington's power for the purposes of domestic consumption in any case. But the idea is that you're not fighting countries because they threaten the United States. You're fighting these countries and trying to conquer these countries because they're not part of this UN-administered world. And to that end, he was talking once again of creating what he called the Leviathan Force. And, of course, Leviathan is an expression in political science that refers to a centralized regime that has pretty much totalitarian power.
And that's exactly where we're moving. Of course, we can't let the American people know that. We, after all, are we a democracy? We'll be back in just a moment with William Greig. Well, you know, one of the most difficult things for the average American to believe is the fact that we go to the polls every 4 years to vote not for the candidate of our choice, but the candidate of the establishment's choice. They run candidates on both political parties, and it really doesn't make a bit of difference, and these policies are going to go ahead irrespective of what the American people want, as long as the elite are able to conceal their existence. But, of course, right now, the next target is the Muslim world. In fact, there's a very interesting gentleman. His name is Kenneth Timmerman. Kenneth Timmerman works with the Washington Times, a couple of other news magazines around. He's very close to Newsmax at the present time and Chris Ruddy, but he's always getting leaks from the government, and of course the government leaks information that they want out. And of course Kenneth Timmerman has been talking for some time about 6 days of hell. 6 days of hell, of course, talking about the attack on Iran and just the total devastation that's going to come as the entire fury of America's Leviathan might, naval might, and cruise missiles are focused on the tragic people of Iran. Recently, of course, in the last couple of days, Kenneth Timmerman has been suggesting that this war is drawing very, very close. He doesn't know whether it'll be before or after the election, but it's only a matter of time before we're at war with Iran and Syria. And I fear, of course, that will lead to a war with the remainder of the Muslim world. But pick the story up there, would you?
Yeah, I think that's a very good analysis of what's happening here, in that we're not withdrawing or retreating from the... When I use the collective pronoun we, I'm referring to the government that rules us. I really have to get out of that habit. But the folks in Washington are not retreating or withdrawing from their demands that Iran behave in certain ways that Iran has already said it has no intention of behaving in order to prevent a war. And I really don't think there's anything Iran could do that would obviate a war, in the same sense that it was pretty clear that there was nothing Saddam Hussein could do in order to avoid a war, up to and including an offer to abdicate. There was an offer on the table to be administered through the Arab League for Saddam Hussein to abdicate with his son. And, of course, he wanted a rather large payoff, but in light of the fact that we're spending something like $1 trillion on the war in Iraq, it would have been a bargain to pay him off, to get him out. I remember very vividly when George W. Bush, on the eve of the attack in March 2003, was talking in the argo of the mythical Western sheriff, telling Saddam and his degenerate sons to get out of town. They were offering to get out of town. They weren't permitted to get out of town. There was nothing that they could have done, including offering to vacate their power, that would have prevented that war from erupting. And I think we're pretty much in the same situation here with Iran, especially when we hear reliable reports to the effect that Dick Cheney's office has been...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is just mentioning, before we get to William was saying about Dick Cheney's office and the inevitability of this coming war with Iran, William, I want you to get out your blog site,
right,
tell people how they can get there, and then I want to get back to Dick Cheney, one of my favorite villains. Go ahead.
Yeah, mine too, unfortunately. My blog is called Pro Libertate. I try to publish something new there between 3 and 5 times a week. Usually what I publish on that blog would be full-length essays between 1,200 and 2,000 words that would take the form of a fully researched opinion piece. I try to provide at least some journalism of first instance. I'm not merely commenting on something that I read in the papers. And my purpose in doing this is to focus on the manifold ways in which human liberty, the individual right vouchsafed to each of us by our Creator, is under assault from the people who rule us at various levels. And I have to focus a lot, unfortunately, on the growing problem of the militarization of the police and the increasingly common spectacle of completely unaccountable law enforcement officers and agencies running roughshod over innocent people. That's a growing problem that's not going to get any better anytime soon, until and unless people find ways of restoring local control over law enforcement. That's something which has been more or less destroyed. The Pro Libertate blog is accessible by Googling Pro Libertate and my last name, Grigg. That will take you right to it. Or you can go through the homepage of the Welsh Foundation, for which I serve in the capacity as an editor at large. And that homepage, which is called The Right Source, is found at www.rightsourceonline.com. rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's one word, rightsourceonline.com. At the top of that page, RightSource, there's a banner ad for my most recent book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can click through at that banner ad and order it from the RightSource directly. It's also available from Radio Liberty, and it's also available on Amazon.com. And if you scroll down the front page of the RightSource, look at the left-hand side of the screen, go down about a third of the way down the page, you'll find a photograph of myself. And next to it, there's a hot link that will take you right to my blog, Pro Libertate. And I think it's important for people to recognize that when I'm writing about what's going on, I may give the impression that there's not a whole lot of hope, that I'm not doing much to engender optimism. That's a criticism I get quite frequently. The problem here is that the affliction that confronts us is so grave and so deeply entrenched, and the ignorance of that affliction, the self-inflicted ignorance of that affliction, is so widespread that I really have to bear down very candidly on what's going on right now. It's the same type of thing that you see, at least I try to emulate, in the writings of somebody like a Patrick Henry. I want to know the whole truth, no matter how discouraging it might be, because we're not going to be able to correct what's going on unless we know the full extent of what's confronting us. And so one of the things, once again, I focus on quite a bit is an unpleasant subject for me, because I was brought up to respect law enforcement, local police, sheriffs, law enforcement agencies acting in their constitutionally assigned roles. I aspire to become a police detective at one point in my life. I'm one of the few journalists I know who have actually taken law enforcement courses and been involved in law enforcement training having to do with terrorism. I actually have a certificate on that subject. I have spent a lot of time in the company of police. I have a lot of friends who are in law enforcement. But what's happened is there's been a systemic change in law enforcement that is just now starting to become visible. And it has to do with the locus of control. Our local police are no longer local in the sense that they are controlled by the communities that they are occupying. They're more like an occupying army. And this is something that is still a recent enough development in our history that if we act very quickly, we can reverse it, but it's something that's going to have to be done very quickly. Heaven help us if we have another terrorist attack, and what's going on in foreign affairs almost ensures that we're going to have another terrorist attack or attacks, because I think that would destroy whatever thin, tenuous hope we have of ever restoring local control over law enforcement. But that, once again, is the sort of thing that I write about quite a bit on Pro Libertate. It's not that I'm out looking for stories of this sort. It's just the stories of this sort are inevitable, unavoidable, and eminently worth reporting on in that blog.
All right, fine. Well, let's get back, of course, then to Dick Cheney. Of course,
yeah.
We were talking about, of course, the fact that all the information suggests we're going to go to war with Iran very, very soon. Kenneth Timmerman is writing about 6 days of hell, and Kenneth Timmerman is a vehicle by which the establishment leaks information. They do it illegally, but basically, of course, they're trying to give us an idea that maybe they're just trying to frighten us to death. I wish that was all there was, but my fear is that they're preparing at least some of us for the inevitable attack that's coming, because our leaders really want to expand the war. They want, of course, to not only damage the enemy, but, of course, to justify a massive increase in their control over our lives, and that's what happens in wartime.
Yeah.
So anyway, then you started to talk about Dick Cheney, so you picked the story up.
Yeah, I talked about the fact that Seymour Hersh, who's a very well-respected investigative journalist, just a couple of weeks ago in a presentation to a group of journalism students, made a point of describing a meeting in the vice president's office that had been described to him by a participant in that event, in which various scenarios for a staged provocation with Iran were discussed, one of which was the idea of having the United States manufacture PT boats that resemble the Iranian fast boats, the craft which are used by the Iranian military to police the Persian Gulf, and to station Navy SEALs on these PT boats and to stage an attack between Navy SEALs and U.S. naval personnel as a casus belli for a war with Iran. And, of course, this would strike a lot of people as ludicrous or unimaginable if they were not familiar with the fact that staged provocations have been used on many, many occasions by many governments, our own most definitely included. You take a look at the nonsense with the Gulf of Tonkin that led us into Vietnam. You take a look at the way that the explosion aboard the Maine in 1898 was used falsely as a pretext for war with Spain, a war that had been very well planned and very capably organized in well in advance of the explosion aboard the Maine. If you take a look at the way that other regimes, such as Nazi Germany, staged various provocations to justify, for instance, case-wide against Poland. You actually had Nazi agents dressed up in Polish uniforms attacking Nazi German fortifications along the border with Poland in 1939 to justify case-wide, which began on September 1st of 1939. And so it's an old trick, basically, to stage a provocation so as to precipitate a desired war. This particular scenario was ruled out by the people in this meeting with Dick Cheney, but the fact that they're talking in terms like this illustrates anew that we're not talking about an administration that's going to back away from a war with Iran. And I suspect you're entirely correct, Dr. Spann, when you say that they want to create facts on the ground so that the successor, no matter who that successor would be, whether it's Obama or McCain, is going to inherit a war and going to have to manage a war in Iran, as well as one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And now, of course, we've got a proxy war going on in Russia's near abroad in Georgia. And if you take a look at these two candidates, Obama and McCain, they are receiving money from the same interests, that is to say, the same entrenched corporatist interests on Wall Street, are backing both of these candidates. Of all the unlikely news outlets to do this, CNN did a fairly detailed rundown of the position of these two candidates on, I believe, two dozen major issues of public concern and decided that they're pretty much interchangeable irrespective of their party labels. I think that the one big difference between the two of them is best described by going back to what Thomas P.M. Barnett, the author of this book, The Pentagon's New Map, this futurist at the Pentagon who's talking about the decades and generations of warfare that our rulers have planned for us, he said we need to divide our military between a systems administrator group and a Leviathan force. The systems administrator group would be involved in nation building. You'd use the military to build civilian institutions, the infrastructure of governance, and they would work hand in hand with diplomatic and economic development people, the sort of people who are involved in this riotous mess called Reconstruction in Iraq. That's the systems administrator force. The Leviathan force is in charge of killing people, breaking things, and breaking nations. I think Obama is a systems administrator in his outlook. He believes in soft power. He believes in multilateralism. He believes that it's perfectly all right to use military force as long as it is done under the aegis of some kind of a UN-directed or UN-administered multilateral effort. John McCain has very little use for multilateralism, but he does not eschew it. He believes in the use of direct blunt force trauma administered through the instrument of the United States military. That's his primary focus. George W. Bush has been sort of a hybrid. He's been sort of a dialectical synthesis of these two views, depending upon the circumstance, and quite frankly, depending upon who's feeding him his lines. He's not a deep thinker or a thinker of any particular note. And I think that Obama would bring the multilateral soft power systems administrator view to the White House, and then within a very brief period of time, he'd acquire whatever was necessary by way of the other point of view. And I believe that if McCain's elected, he will come in bristling with ambition to carry out the Leviathan force agenda, and within 6 months or however long it would take, he would start acquiring whatever was needed out of the systems administrator view in order to please his masters. Doesn't really matter which direction they come from, what their specific vector is. The people who are controlling these campaigns can make use of either one of them, and the people who would be set to tutor them would lead them in whichever direction as far as the candidate would need to be led in order to be a perfect dialectical synthesis for the interests of the people behind the throne. And that's one of the reasons why presidential politics is such a snare and a delusion. By the time you get to the point of a nominating convention and an actual campaign, the people behind the scenes have already made sure that their bets have been hedged and covered. And that's certainly the case right now. I, to be blunt, don't think that Obama is going to be elected. He's the odds-on favorite right now, certainly in the media. Certainly he's being positioned as somebody who represents an irresistible political trend. I think there are people who are starting to close their prayers in the name of Barack Obama, quite frankly. So deep and expansive is this messianic delusion surrounding this completely unremarkable machine politician from Illinois. I really don't think he's going to be elected. I could be wrong, but if he's elected, he wouldn't be that different materially from John McCain. He'd know how to operate a laptop computer. That's something beyond McCain's competence. He's somebody who can read a teleprompter. Once again, John McCain has insurmountable difficulty with that mundane task. But apart from that, there really wouldn't be a whole lot of difference. Minor differences in style, minor differences in approach, but substantively they'd be about the same. If McCain is elected, I suspect what's going to happen is that from the moment that he's given the authority of the presidency, he's going to be actively seeking to promote and expand the military agenda. But once again, there's only so much that he's going to be able to do before he's reined in. I believe that the dials have been set for this conflict in Iran. Actually, of the two candidates, the one who is more militant about Iran is Obama. Obama's made a point of talking about his willingness to take any measure in order to prevent Iran from acquiring nukes. McCain, of course, has been bellicose toward Iran as well. It's just that the pronouncements on the part of Barack Obama have been much more florid and melodramatic, and lead me to believe that just as Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and others have suggested in very portentous ways that they would be willing to use tactical nukes against Iran, that Barack Obama would be suitably inclined to do so as well from the perspective of the power elite. So what we're going to have to do is recognize the fact and prepare for the fact that if we end up in a conflict with Iran, it's going to become very ugly very soon. There are going to be immediate economic repercussions. We're going to find the price of oil, which is starting to come down right now as the speculative bubble starts to seep. The air starts to seep out of the speculative bubble, rather. We're going to see the price of oil, which is not going to come down that dramatically, shoot up to stratospheric heights that are presently unimaginable. We're almost certainly going to find retaliatory acts not only against the military in the Persian Gulf area and elsewhere in the world, but also here against the United States. And that's one of the consequences of starting up a war with the entire Muslim world. And Dr. Stan, when you talk about the fact that warfare is used as a way of reordering our society or any society that is taken into a war by its leaders, I believe that's almost always the primary motivation of starting a war. I believe that the territorial conquest incident of the war and the material enrichment incident of the war is often a secondary consideration. The real desire is to find ways of enhancing the power of whoever happens to be ruling a given country and using the the climate of opinion that develops in a war as a way of breaking down certain impediments to enhancing the power of the ruling elite. That was certainly the case, as you well know, and have spoken of on many occasions back in the years before World War I, when the Carnegie Endowment was looking at some way to get the United States involved in a war so as to reorder society.
Well, of course, this is exactly the same thing. What was Vietnam all about? I mean,
yes.
Why did we go over there and fight for 10 years? Because we wanted to bring in the Great Society. Because we wanted to bring in, you know, the change in the immigration laws. Because we wanted to take God and prayer out of our schools. Because they wanted to centralize all power in Washington, D.C. And how can I make that statement? Well, very simply, because in essence, why make George Bundy, the National Security Advisor, member of Skull and Bones, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote an article in January of 67 in Foreign Affairs magazine where he said, you know, the road forward at home is not by pulling out of Vietnam. Don't say we ought to pull out of Vietnam. We pull out of Vietnam, there's going to be objection to our domestic policies. If you believe in the great new departures in health and education and welfare and in rebuilding our society and true equality, don't say we ought to get out of Vietnam. That was the man who got us into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I was as much responsible, he and McNamara, that trumped up this phony Gulf of Tonkin incident. They wanted the war to change America. I think you're absolutely right, William. And my concern is that the coming war is going to even lead to more drastic changes in America.
It's entirely reasonable to suspect that if we end up in this civilizational conflict with the Muslim world, which, by the way, is a conflict for which there is not a whole lot of enthusiasm in the Muslim world. That's a very highly promoted misunderstanding on the part of the West, is that supposedly there are these teeming, faceless hordes of Mohammedans who just lust for a conflict with the West. That's not true. There are, of course, plenty of militants, most of whom are subsidized by the West, who are willing to fight a war with the West. But by and large, the Muslim world is composed of people who want to tend to their own vine and fig tree, if you will. They really don't care much for the idea of jihad in the form of militant, aggressive conflict against the unbelievers. That's just not the way that most people act most of the time.
And, of course, the American people don't want the war.
Exactly.
But there is a small group that does want the war. Ladies and gentlemen, why aren't you out the streets demonstrating with the anti-war protesters? Of course, most of them are controlled by the other side as well. We'll be right back with William Grieg to wrap up the program. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program here.
I do appreciate, Dr. Stan, the fact that you talked in the last segment about the aversion that most people have for the designs of those who want to rule the world. Most people, left to their own devices, would not seek out the types of conflicts that are being orchestrated for the benefit of the people who seek to rule us. There really isn't this huge constituency for a generational war between the West and the Muslim world on either side of that divide. Just as there was not a huge constituency in the Soviet Union or in the United States for a nuclear standoff or a potential war between the United States and Soviet Russia. And so you have these conflicts that are orchestrated and that are blown up through the deliberate misrepresentations through the media as a way of mobilizing and radicalizing people. I think one of the purposes being served by this conflict in Georgia, quite frankly, is to help regiment Russian society. The people who are running Russia need the image of an enemy, an external enemy, to do certain things in that society, just as the people running the United States need the image of an external enemy to justify regimenting our society and transforming it into a garrison state. So I think that if people are able to communicate with each other and expose what's going on in terms that can be understood on the basis of our common humanity. We're all created in the image of the same God, remember. I think that there is some hope that we can palliate some of these staged conflicts and we can start treating with each other in ways that will cut our would-be rulers out of the equation. At least that's the world I would prefer to live in, where people have an understanding of what's being done to us and then we mutually reject it and try to find ways of building a better world on the basis of freedom under God's law.
I agree with you totally. And, of course, the thing is, our job and your job by writing and my job with being here on radio 5 times a day is to try to educate people, to make people that realize that men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose.
Exactly.
And, of course, we're not going to change this unless we can let people know there's a problem. And I think you do a great job with your blog, and I hope at least that we've got listeners out there. Well, I know we have listeners all across America, all across the world. We're learning, and I really appreciate so much your willingness to come on with us a couple of times a week here on Radio Liberty and share your thoughts, because I find even though we don't talk off the air, or at least if we do, it's very seldom, but our thoughts are so very similar. Parting thought before we let you go.
Parting thought is that you are completely correct in reminding our listeners that the people who seek to rule us have a different God. They worship themselves rather than worshiping their creator.
God bless you. Thank you so very much.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, William Grieg was just saying that he agrees with me that the problem that we have is that the people who are in positions of power worship a different God, that they worship themselves. But of course, this is Lucifer's basic concept. There is a Luciferian movement, the Gnostic movement is alive and well in America today, and the fact that our religious leaders are not warning us about the Gnostic religion, I suspect a lot of them don't even understand the influence of Gnosticism within upper echelons of the Rosicrucians and the Theosophists and the Masons and really within the Vatican and certainly even within the Protestant Church. This Gnosticism, this Gnostic religion permeates every aspect of society today, and we do hope that many of you will want to get our talk on the forbidden secret. That's the forbidden secret. It will give you some insight into how this puts together, and of course the sequel to that is Secret Knowledge. These are two DVDs available from Radio Liberty that you're not going to get elsewhere. Of course, my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness is foundational to really beginning to grasp how this all fits together to help you connect the dots. Certainly, we hope many of you want to get our talk on the planned police state. And, of course, the syllabus that goes with that is very important because you'll actually get some of the writings from the other side there. And if you get any of our items, I suggest you ask for the pamphlet, The Workings of the Spiritual Hierarchy. The Workings of the Spiritual Hierarchy. Who wrote it? Why, it was channeled to a woman named Alice Bailey by a demonic spirit. And it lays out exactly what's going on today. It comes right from the very horse's mouth. That's The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. Lucius Trust circulates it, and so I figure we might as well circulate it as well. They want you to tell you it's good. We want you to tell you the terrible menace that hangs over our society today. And then, of course, we do want to encourage you to get the very professionally done DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. That's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And the sequel to that, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And you'll be taken on a tour of the Capitol, which will give you an entirely different perspective. Because, you see, when America was created in 1787, there were two forces here. One was the occult, the demonic, and the other was the Christian. And the predominant Christians, most of the people who were involved in America were the Christians. But, of course, the people who were gone over to the other side were here as well. That's why they had to hide their emblem in the back of the Great Seal of the United States. They hid on the back of the Great Seal of the United States in 1782. Why, the picture of the pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye, and not until 1935, when they were in complete and total control of our government, did they put it on the back of the dollar bill. But that is a Luciferian emblem, and that eye you're looking at is the eye of Lucifer. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And the emblem, of course, the all-seeing eye, was the emblem of the ancient mystery religions, which is manifested today in literally a dozen or more organizations working at the upper echelons of our government and our society, intent upon a one-world government, a one-world religion, a one-world ruler. And then, of course, we do hope many of you will want to get our videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. They sold their souls for rock and roll. And then, of course, please go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet. Certainly, 9 hours a day, but you can get 4 live hours, and programs are archived. They're available on MP3. And then, of course, go to our section on videos, and you can watch a lot of videos up there free. Go to the section on other videos. Watch Building 7 come down. You scroll down to Building 7. Watch Building 7 come down. Watch the Twin Towers come down. Understand, these are controlled demolitions. Who would have done such a terrible deed? It would have to be somebody terribly evil. But that, of course, is exactly what we're up against today. And the fact that most people do not understand the spiritual nature of the battle, that there really are people there who worship a different God, is why, we have the problems we do today. So we ask you to remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Remember our all-day seminar on the 26th of October, and give us a call and make your reservations, and then pray for